Episode 12, the final episode in the serial season called Farewell Evangelicalism. Why not a farewell episode? A farewell episode for Farewell Evangelicalism, where we've offered the tools, the receipts, to help folks who are still in evangelical or conservative church traditions to find their way out, or those who are on the path of leaving to get the tools to figure out what it looks like to exit. But it's one thing to show the emperor with no clothes. It's quite another to pave a new path, giving new ideas of what the potential and possibilities of liberation and wholeness look like. And that's where this episode comes in. One question I asked the majority of my guests was, what does better look like? Their answers have been compiled in this episode. We will begin by summarizing the problems that we encountered along the way, naming how conspiracy theory and propaganda are used as tools to govern thought and belief in evangelicalism. It sounds political because it is. From there, we will peel back the layers and give tools to listeners to help you identify all of the weird, and from the weird, hopefully, glimpses of hope. My name is Rohatty. I've been the host and producer of this serial season, and I am recording on Treaty 7 territory. I asked most of my guests to name the traditional territories on which their feet touch, because that is just a small action to acknowledge the first peoples of the land, a small decolonial action that we can all take part in. I am on the traditional territory of the peoples of the Treaty 7, which include the Blackfoot Confederacy, comprised of the Siksika and Piikani and Kainai First Nations. We are also near Tsuut'ina First Nation and the Stoney Nakoda, which includes the Chiniki, Bearspaw, and Goodstoney First Nations. Calgary is also the home to Métis Nation of Alberta Region 5 and 6. Thank you to all the guests who came through to share their expertise across 12 episodes. As well, thank you to you, dear listeners. Thank you for rating and reviewing. It goes a long way for indie productions such as this. Also, thank you for sharing it and putting it into the hands of those who are trying to figure out their own voice, to find it, to also seek out their liberation and make sense of all of their religious experiences that wound up getting weird or even harmful. Finding the tools and the language necessary to take the next step in a deconstruction journey, or even the tools just to leave toxic community, goes a long way to help you find yourself. So let's go back into time. In this review and summary episode, episode 12 in Farewell Evangelicalism, we'll go back into episode 3 and 4 by revisiting the problem, the core of the issue at hand. That makes sense of why evangelicalism and conservative Christians are more interested in their self-interest and their own political power than they are with actually following the teachings of Jesus. Let's start with Scott Coley. Scott helps us make sense of the motivations behind belief systems in evangelicalism. Turns out, evangelicals are really selfish.
And it has a lot to do with self-interest and propping up and perpetuating and legitimizing a social order that has historically benefited white evangelicals. Once I set aside the need to claim that the allocation of wealth in my society is based on merit, which is a fantasy,
yeah.
Then I can start to let go of a lot of these, you know, like this notion that, I've seen sort of people who are influential in Christian nationalist spaces and adjacent sort of, you know, conservative or politically right spaces make the suggestion that, you know, World War II veterans, for example, just came home from killing Nazis and grabbed a hold of their bootstraps and just pulled themselves up.
Yeah, sure.
Which
yeah,
is, I mean, you went. Yeah. just utterly fantastical. The plain fact is that the single greatest period of wealth creation and economic growth in the history of the United States, if not the history of the entire world, was made possible by a steeply progressive income tax and redistribution. Now, of course, the benefits of that redistribution were restricted to white people. The U.S. government created the white middle class through a system of mortgage insurance, which I document in the book. And that, I mean, that's not the only thing that's going on, but I mean, very arguably that fact alone is sufficient to account for the wealth disparity, the racial wealth gap that we see now. But yeah, once I let go of the need to justify the established order, then all of a sudden I'm not so committed to interpreting certain proof texts in such and such a way. And I'm not committed to getting so defensive anytime, you know, an outside or quote unquote secular expert speaks, right? I would argue that it's that once you give up that sort of need to legitimize social arrangements that benefit yourself, then you are free to look dispassionately at these different kinds of arguments and say, yeah, that's bogus.
The power of rugged individualism coupled with effective propaganda or messaging is going to make the jump to a space of self-realization, or you use the perfect word, to be attuned to what's going on in our bodies and in our beliefs, to get to a place where you would acquiesce what is effectively one of the most central pillars of America, and we'll throw Canada in the mix there, of giving up your, you know, I got mine notion of individualism and success, coupled with the side of capitalism and then all the powers that are going to prop that up. It's a tough sell to get to a place where you might entertain the possibilities of a collective liberation through policy.
I think part of what I find particularly troubling at the moment, right, is that, like, I feel like a lot of people were starting to get the argument, say, for example, like, well, look at the racial wealth gap. You know, you either have to accept that there's something about the system. We're not talking about, like, you know, just a sort of a statistical, like a slight, there's slightly disproportionate or something. There's a massive racial wealth gap. So either you accept that there's something with the system that has created this outcome, or you kind of believe in white superiority, right? I feel like about the time that argument gained some traction, you know, now I mean, the last 5 years or so, we've seen a real uptick in sort of the, at least in the spaces I see online, of sort of the broader social acceptability of explicitly racist kinds of thinking. That I think you
and
wouldn't.
The deletion of.
That we really haven't seen in polite company, you know, since, what, like the 60s or something, you know, but you've got, I mean, just people, just bald, scientific, like nasty scientific rate, like Nazi stuff.
Yeah. You know, literally Nazi stuff.
Literally. Right. And so then you say, like, okay, well, you believe that wealth is allocated on the basis of merit. What do you say about the racial wealth gap? And they'll just say, like, yeah, I said what I said.
There was such a weird time where we were not capable of entertaining some of these ideas, and that the revisionist history and deletion of history happening before our eyes is quickly replacing, when you put it that way, replacing some of the progress, although minute, and ultimately, I think the white supremacist underlay underneath the floorboards has always been there. It's only now coming out for its last gasp attempt.
One would hope.
I hope last.
Yeah. Well, that's what the whole second chapter of the book is about this sort of this white supremacist pathology, whether it's explicit or implicit, runs throughout so much of white evangelical theology, going back to defenses of race-based chattel slavery.
You have language in the midst of a lot of evangelical and conservative, specifically leaders who are decrying the work of deconstruction, calling it evil and sinful and whatever other words they're trying to jam down. They see the rattle, I think, that the cage is the facade, the foundations are starting to crumble because people are asking questions. And you give some language here that I haven't seen before that associated with propaganda, that deconstruction, the folks who are in that process of deconstructing are actually trying to decode propaganda.
As far as I can tell, it's a process of disentangling the teachings of Jesus from a certain approach to politics that we might associate with, say, the moral majority. I mean, there's a kind of tell, I think, with the folks who get really hysterical about, can you believe, you know, all these people are deconstructing or whatever, which is they don't really bother differentiating between people who are walking away from their faith altogether and people who are just sort of trying to settle on a different iteration of the faith. I don't think think it makes that big of a difference to the people that are hysterical about it, because either of those outcomes is a threat to their power. Whether I'm leaving Christianity altogether or I'm just walking away from that iteration of Christianity, I'm not giving them my money anymore. I'm not voting the way they want me to vote. And it makes no difference to them.
Whenever you notice that leadership in conservative Christian traditions are finding new pariahs, they're finding people to blame, finding people to fear, it's really a distraction from what isn't working within the fold. And as more and more people start to exit the toxicity and the damage and the abuse within evangelical church traditions, you're going to find more and more church leaders try to decry the movement of folks trying to find their own liberation. They will use propaganda to control beliefs, because if you can control beliefs, then you can control bodies. I asked Jared Stacy, now you might remember him from episode 4 on conspiracy theory, on whether or not, after the past 2 decades now, evangelicals actually can make any informed decisions for better, or are they stuck in a loop of harm?
I think 2 things. The first thing I would say is that one key element for my pilgrimage has been the recognition that a lot of the necessary critical clarity over the situation of the American churches already exists. It exists in the global South. It exists in theologies that have been articulated outside of America and speak of America and our capitulation with a lot of clarity and grace and mercy, but still a lot of clarity. So I think the recognition that a lot of the work that we're looking for is taking place, it's just not taking place in places that we might expect, in places that the academy directs our attention to. Certainly not places where consumable faith is going to direct your. I mean, you're not going to if evangelicalism is something that we consume, you're not going to consume James Cone. You're not going to consume Gustavo Gutierrez. You're not going to encounter the non-American voices who know something about America. Even in a, I'm thinking of Munther Isaac and Raheb, the Reverend Raheb, the Palestinian theologian. I heard him this past month, and again, the consumable evangelicalism is not going to. You're not going to find these voices easily.
Not within the empire. Yeah, you need to extricate outside of the boundaries of the boundaries of the cog, eh?
Yeah, I think just to put a very quick statement on it, I think just listening to Dr. Raheb, it occurred to me that the most potent and the most necessary theology is coming from Palestinian theologians who see with a lot of clarity, because they're beneath the foot of the beast. They can articulate in ways that we are wont to do and difficult for us to do. They can articulate a Christian witness that needs a hearing.
Yeah, a contemporary Christian witness that is underneath rubble.
And that goes back to how we were talking about theology in the first place. Like, and let's make a contrast. If conspiracy theory is always explaining things in a way that is meant to keep things the way that they're supposed to be, right? The Democrats are stealing the election. We got to do something. We got to maintain the way that things are.
Yeah, yeah.
Theology is a way of talking that totally upends everything that we've taken for granted as given. These ways of speaking are diametrically opposed to one another. That if conspiracy theory is how we narrate the world in order to give ourselves the imagination to keep things from changing, theology comes in and announces this word that announces that a new creation is coming. And that's revolutionary. And at the same time, we find ourselves at this intersection where does that word gain a hearing among us? One of the things that was put to me in a very direct way was considering apostasy as an act of faith. Ooh. Considering leaving.
Okay, hang on. We got to do that again because that's like too deep. That's like too deep, too fast, man. We got to linger. Apostasy as an act of faith. Unpack for us.
Our salvation is not rooted in the survival of a particular movement. And the question that I came asking as an evangelical walking on the border and then outside these spaces was, how do I fix it? How do we repair it? And then someone asked me, well, what if apostasy is the act of faith? What if that's the path of discipleship? And to say apostasy as an act of faith is to still consider what it is to be Christian outside the bounds of a movement that claims to speak for the whole. That's what I am noticing about my people of white evangelicals. Yeah. Is that even living outside the states, white evangelicalism claims to speak for the nation, and it claims to speak for biblical Christianity.
Absolutely.
And you can't reconcile those two.
They don't. If you dig into the book, something's amiss.
Right.
Does not compute.
And in the same way that conspiracy theory is always trying to keep the social order intact, theology
particular
is...
particular social order, yeah.
Theology always comes in to speak of a God who doesn't leave us without responsibility, but who liberates and invites us to witness. And so, you know, I am a recovering cynic in every shape of word.
I hear you.
And I think what has stirred me and challenged me is the sense that resistance and that Christian witness is so often not romantic. It is very intimate and very boring and tedious. It's not that it's without risk, but it doesn't often have the platform that we think it does. And when I read theologians who engaged in resistance during the Second World War, one of them was K.H. Muscote, and he has this quip that I've just memorized because it's so good. He says that the church is the church by faith in becoming the church again and again. And that gives this cynic who kind of risks worshiping the God of fate that he says, hey, this is just the way things are, that there's always an inbreaking. And it doesn't always issue in political power or even the recognition of historians, but it is real. And it does renew the church in every age. And I think I'm coming to realize that the way of discipleship for the rest of our lives in the time that we're living is this venture of not just building, because that kind of gets back into the entrepreneurial, like Silicon Valley, like let me, see a church out here. But the venture of finding where this church is being born. And it'll only be in looking back that we'll be able to even narrate with any sense of spiritual sensitivity, maybe this is where it happened or not.
Yeah.
I like what Bonhoeffer says. He says, you know, that people cannot create a new beginning with God. They can only pray for one. Where is this God, and how do we venture with him? And I think that puts us in a great place of uncertainty. And it and that's where it's really interesting, because that is precisely the opposite of what conspiracy theory offers. Conspiracy theory offers nothing but certainty. And part of, I think, being disciples amidst so much disinformation is recapturing the joy of venturing with God into these voids where uncertainty is just the normal part of our being together. And I think that uncertainty does a lot of things. I think it opens our eyes up to encountering people that the stories that are spun in our society just don't stick to. We're talking about freedom. We're talking about liberation, but we're talking about it as Christians, not as capitalists, not as Marxists per se. And those things are floating beneath the surface, and people don't give them much credit. So
apostasy as an act of faith, I won't forget that, because it connects the dots between the old broke thing doesn't have to be around in order for us to find a more liberative posture and community. Now, theology, conspiracy theory, propaganda, those components can definitely be heady. There's something to be said when we try to return to the person or to the teachings of Jesus, because it can be said that there are many Christian traditions acting very Christian, yet bringing harm, because Christian doesn't necessarily mean Christ-like. Here's Robert Callahan returning with a metaphor to help explain.
I mean, another way to think of it is, you know, if you're familiar with the Chronicles of Narnia, there's spoiler alert for everybody.
Okay. Give him a second here in case, you know.
cue the whole music. Da, da, da,
da, da. Okay, come back in 60 seconds. Okay, yeah.
But there's the storyline in one of the last books where there's an intentional ruse that's being played on the community. Like one of the animals finds a mane, a lion's mane, and puts it on a donkey and calls that donkey Aslan and walks around everywhere saying, "It's Aslan, it's Aslan." And like, you know, all these creatures start, you know, following and worshiping Aslan. And so like they are doing those things in Aslan's name, but that is not Aslan. That is not Jesus. And so, you know, you can have every intention of trying to worship God and just completely miss the whole point. Yeah. And so one of the things that when we're talking about whether or not we should continue in these abusive spaces and how hard should we fight to try to reclaim, you know, how hard should we fight to try to redeem people from their ways? Gary Thomas, in his book, When to Walk Away, talks about one thing that you don't see from Jesus when people have disagreed with him is him giving chase. You know, he's not like running after them and saying, "But wait, there's more." You know, if they disagreed, then, you know, okay. Yeah. You were told.
Yeah. Yeah. We're too busy on this side seeking out life. Finding communities that give life is ultimately the catalyst to help folks leave evangelical church traditions, because they realize what's inside the fold is life-taking, not life-giving. That those within conservative or evangelical church traditions are seeking their own self-interest, and they do not look like Jesus. They do not follow the teachings of radical love, of justice, of beauty, of hope. When folks decide to leave malformed and harmful church traditions, eventually it's because the cost to stay greatly outweighs the cost to leave. Here's D.L. Mayfield back to talk about the cost of losing family and community, but then on the other side, how to find your people.
Yeah, the way my brain is going to answer this question is to sort of, I don't know if it's zooming out or actually digging in deeper. I think before you can find those communities, or maybe just at the same time, the number one thing you can do to sort of start to heal from this kind of an upbringing, or even start to heal if you live in a society run by folks like this, run by white evangelicals, run by white supremacists, patriarchalists, who are also Christians, you know, like, so a lot of us have to deal with that. The best thing you can do, and this has actually been talked about by psychologists who have studied, like what happened in the Third Reich, the people who were the most able to resist an authoritarian regime are people who had the strongest connection to their true selves. And so doing whatever you can to create a relationship with your true self outside of all of those parameters put around you, especially if you come from a high control environment, which white evangelicalism is, the more you can do this work to be like, this is who I am, it actually will then give you the tools you need to see what communities can I be a part of? Which ones am I being drawn to? Because if you don't have a strong sense of self, you're kind of going to panic and just go wherever, or you might find yourself in abusive relationships. You might find yourself being like, so for me, I went into activism right after I kind of left Christianity, and kind of simultaneously. Now, there's elements of activism, I'm sure you know this, right? Where people are just like shitting on each other all the time. And I was like, yeah, this feels good. This feels normal.
It's like, you know, it's like that, obviously, like that trauma bonding.
Yeah, exactly. And like, I deserve to feel shitty every waking minute of my life.
Okay.
For the cause, you know? And I was like, wait a minute, that seems like what I was told in childhood. So the more I've connected to my true self, now I can be like, okay, this is an issue I actually can help out in. This is what I can do. Here's something that's actually beyond my capacity, but at least I know that now. Here's what I can do. It's like, there's just these really positive impacts that come from actually developing and nurturing that relationship with yourself. As a non-binary person, you know, I didn't even know I was allowed to be non-binary. I just knew growing up in this world, I was a terrible girl, you know, like I just, and I was clocked that way. I mean, people know when you're autistic, and people know when you're not a extremely femme person, you know, in this world. And so I've been getting kind of negative feedback for both of those things in my life, my whole life, but just internalized it, you know. And now I'm like, wow, getting the opportunity to be like, I'm autistic and I have some real nervous system sensitivities that I need to start taking seriously. And also I'm non-binary, therefore I don't need to spend a ton of energy trying to perform, you know, femininity. And just even that seems like so simple and so easy. It's not, but it's been like allowing myself to get to know myself in those two ways alone has just had so many positive benefits. And I'm just naturally finding community with other people who are like, I'm also autistic. I've thought this through. Here's how I'm taking care of myself. Here's how I'm taking care of my community. Same thing with non-binary people, right? The queer community is so incredible and such a great community to look to for times of resistance, of joyful resistance, of embodied, you know, not just being in your head and finding Donald Trump in your head all the time. Like, we actually have our bodies, and our bodies going forward in this authoritarian regime, right? Our bodies are going to experience anxiety, terror, pain, fear. They're also going to experience joy, pleasure, awe, curiosity, hope. Like, we get to have all of those. We don't just have to have one or the other. We get to have all of it. And by connecting with your true self, you will start to realize, wow, all of these emotions are in me, right? And I can't pick and choose. I have to experience them all, and I have to live through them all. And I think that's actually really hopeful, because then we get to say, well, then I get to have some of the good parts of being a human too, even in really intense times. Like, it's really not fun to be non-binary right now, let me tell you. But at the same time, I'm like, I'm so glad I had a few years to just really be curious about myself and my story and gender, and I wouldn't trade it for the world, even though it's led to some pretty stressful things in my life, you know? So I guess connected to your true self historically has been known to defeat fascism, and also has the added benefit of, like, you get to have this relationship with yourself where you're curious and you don't shame yourself. And then I would say, find a way to pour into kids, you know, in a non-creepy way. Find a way to make the world a softer place for everyone's children. And that's kind of what's giving me hope. And that's the communities I kind of want to focus on and look toward. Gen Z and Gen Alpha have a lot to say. And I hope we can continue to listen to them. You know, that's the opposite of Dr. Dobson. He's like, kids need to be controlled and silenced. And I think, what if we let kids be as mad as they are about the world they were born into? You know?
Earlier, I mentioned how Christianity comes in many forms. There's no one single expression. It's Christianities, not Christianity. And those Christianities don't necessarily follow Christ. That's how we can say folks might be acting very Christian and also are the harbingers of harm. So what does it look like to follow Christ? What does the better way look like? Is there even a more life-giving way of Christianity to both embody, to join, to be invited into? And it's at this point we pivot to look squarely at some of the foundational teachings of Jesus and how they might inform us. Whether or not we're in a church, that may not matter. What does matter is the ethics that we choose to embody and live out. Here's Marlena Graves to talk about being a good neighbor.
So I think it should blow people's mind, and it did mine when I first learned this, that, you know, righteousness and justice are the same words used in scripture often. Okay, if justice is used for righteousness, and a righteous person is someone who is supposed to be just, you see that all throughout the Old Testament, New Testament, like Jesus, like, blessed are the poor, blessed, you know. If you say you're a Christian, you don't give your brother or sister knee James, you know, what good are you? That has never been separated. In the early church, it was not separated. And those that know Christian history should know that, that, you know, giving to the poor, helping the poor, praying, like, the more that you love God, it should follow that you love your neighbor more, not in your mind, but in really concrete ways. And Saint Anthony said, your life and your death are tied up in your neighbor. That's early monastics. Your salvation, your life and your death are tied up with that of your neighbors. So they're saying, if you don't love your neighbor in concrete ways, then you better be careful. Like, if you're espousing the gospel, because maybe you're not where you think you are. So my life and death is bound up in your flourishing. And I'm looking out the window, my local neighbor's flourishing. The Eastern Orthodox say this, you know, God doesn't ask you what your doctrine was. God says, when I was hungry, did you feed me? You love God with all your heart, soul, and mind. You're going to love your neighbors as yourself. Like St. Anthony said, our life and death is bound up with our neighbors.
When we talk about loving thy neighbor, we start to get concrete with actions that really everyone knows in their head, or at least should, yet many choose to ignore. These are foundational and central teachings of Jesus. And yes, many Christians will do harm in the name of Christianity, and that is very distinctly Christian, but it's a particular brand of Christianity. Those who are acting Christ-like will seek to embody the characters of Jesus, which includes a love for thy neighbor. Now, what does that actually pragmatically look like in community in this modern day age? The obvious answer is, of course, you love your literal neighbors. That's part of it. Doesn't need nuance. But there are also different expressions of what that looks like in public. I asked a number of my guests across 12 episodes the question of, what does liberation in faith or in community look like for you? The pictures differ, of course, but there are some themes as well. And within their stories, perhaps you will find a component that works in your context. I have included three responses in this episode. We'll start with Kate West. You remember her from episode Patriarchy. And then Celeste Irwin. You'll remember her from episode Trans Liberation.
Yeah, after I stopped going to a Presbyterian church and an evangelical church, I didn't want to lose sight of my curiosity and spirituality. Mm-hmm. And so even though I find myself in an agnostic space, I still am very curious about spiritual things. And I like to read things like liberation theology. And so things like child liberation theology or Black liberation theology, womanist theology, and especially Indigenous peoples' spiritual books, such as Caitlin Curtis, Randy Woodley and Caitlin Curtis, books have been really helpful to me in expanding my view of the world and who we can be as spiritual beings. Mm-hmm. And yeah. So I feel like it's a very expansive thing. You know, this liberation is not restrictive or trying to keep me in the tiniest of boxes. It's opening up the world so that I can breathe and be a full human being. And so I appreciate just learning from other people who, even if they don't believe the same things I do as an, you know, agnostic person, but I find that their viewpoints are really helpful in opening my eyes to more than just myself.
Yeah, totally. I love that. For women who are in the clutches of Christian patriarchy movement, or even in churches that are touching that, because it comes in so many different shapes and sizes. You've given us some pieces of and tools and tips of what you can do in the midst of trying to find yourself in the mess. Any pillars of advice or aspects of be alert to this, pay attention to that?
It's interesting that you ask that and frame it that way, because I think the way I grew up in Christian patriarchy, people often say it's very extreme, and I'll grant that, but also many churches experience patriarchy. Even the church I went to after I left, a few years in, they started bringing books from patriarchal leaders into the mm-hmm. church and the mm-hmm. Sunday school. And no one was listening to me when I brought it up. They just thought it was just fine. And I was trying to explain the background, the context of this. So it is a sinister kind of influence. And so for anybody who's hearing patriarchal beliefs or experiencing a patriarchal church or a family, or doesn't even know that they are, and perhaps they're getting some red flags, I would say to look out where the power is happening in your community or your family.
Mm.
Who is at the top? Is there somebody at the top? And what happens if you disagree or you say something that doesn't align with that leader or leaders? What happens when you do that? Do you get silenced, or are you allowed to speak? And so, you know, people who are in complementarian marriages where they think that a man has a role of a leader, a woman has a role of a helper, and they think that women should submit. And that I get frustrated when people say that's their choice, because if you're choosing to submit to somebody, you are giving up your choice. Mm. You're giving up your agency. And so if you're in a truly complementarian marriage, that's actually a patriarchal marriage.
Yeah.
And I would say look out for that, because once you give up your agency, you have no say of what happens to you in your body. And it's important for every single person, whatever gender they are, to have your individual rights intact, that you have access to finances and decision-making power. If people choose to be a stay-at-home partner, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about people who are giving up their entire means of being a person in the world to submit to another person. That's very dangerous, and it can escalate. And so I don't feel like I'm exaggerating with this, because I've seen it happen where people start off with a somewhat neutral relationship or a neutral church, and it becomes radicalized, or it gets more extreme with the belief system, and it's based on this hierarchy. And so I always resist authoritarianism and hierarchy. And I think that as communities, we need to figure out a different way to exist with each other.
When I think about life-giving community, first and foremost, I think of queer and trans people need to be able to be proudly themselves. Right. And that means we need to even get rid of, and I didn't talk about this before, but we need to even get rid of the respectability politics of gay people are fine as long as they are monogamous and two kids and a dog, just like the straight people. Right. We need to get rid of that. We need to let queer people be who they want to be. And for some queer people, that will mean, you know, monogamous with two kids and a dog, and love that for them. And for others, it's going to mean polyamory. It's going to mean, colored hair. I have blue hair right now. It's going to mean all these different things. And it's not going to be looking like your whatever idealistic white supremacist view of what people should be. Yeah. Mm. So you have to, it means a constant deconstruction of these social norms, and letting people be exactly who they want to be, which is amazing. In all ways. And we're still doing it. There's still tons of ways that we keep finding, oh wait, no, there's another thing that we haven't really peeled back yet. Let's do that. Question that thing to that thing. And then we find other things where it's like, no, that actually makes sense. But we need to have spaces that are centered around, or at least that foreground queer flourishing, not just queer acceptance.
Yeah.
Right. That understand that queerness is needed in a healthy community. Not just accepted. It's like, no, your community's incomplete until you have flourishing queer people in it.
And not just tokenized either and slotted into a particular space. It's like there's a full participation for marginalized people. And when you can fully participate in community, that's very different than you slotted me into the gap.
Right. And just like with Black people, Indigenous people, immigrants, disabled people, women, etc., neurodiverse people, any number of these axes, just like with all of them, every single one of those people is going to bring in new perspectives that are challenging to everybody else.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's going to be great when we honor those things and we say, well, that's new and I hadn't thought of that before, but that's actually really going to be good. As opposed to when we say, oh, but that's going to be inconvenient, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's going to be hard, right?
You assimilate to us.
You know, the deaf community says that they want a ASL interpreter for sermons or for, you know, talks or for whatever it is, you know, community is happening. And that's going to be expensive.
Yeah.
Like, it is. Right. Like, but why do you get to, you know, so anyway, there's those things, but it needs to be built around that flourishing. It needs to be built around thriving. It needs to be built around recognizing that queerness, you know, when I talk about queerness, particularly, that queerness isn't a problem to be solved. It's not something that it's like, okay, you can be here and that's not great. I'm so sorry for you that you're trans, but, you know, we'll make it work for you, right? Or something that.
No.
It's, you know, it needs to be, again, if I'm using Christian language, this is why it's baffling to me when I have evangelicals that want me to not be who I am. It's like, when you look at the words of Jesus and you see him say, I came that you would have abundant life. Well, I didn't have that before I transitioned. Mm-hmm. Not even close.
Yeah.
Now I do.
Yeah.
I smile more. I'm more loving. When you look at the fruits of the Spirit, every single one, I can go down the list and I can give you a long, you know, I could write a long essay about how every single one was lacking before and is just absolutely unbelievably present in my life now, right? Mm. My kids will tell you that I'm a better parent now that I've transitioned. My partner will say that I'm a better partner since I transitioned. My friends say I'm a better friend, right? All these people around me are like, you're so much more fun and easy to be around. You're so much more full of life. You're so much more supportive, more caring, more gentle, right? I don't have a temper like I used to when I had testosterone going through a body that does not know what to do with testosterone, right? It's awful. And now I don't have that, and I would never go back. Wouldn't dream of it. Because I can't live that way. And so it's got to be built around recognizing that this is good, actually, right? Not just a thing to be solved. So that those are components of it.
I so deeply value you sharing pieces of yourself and your story. I think as you were naming, as you were painting a picture of what that life-giving community looks like and the potential it produces when it is radically accepting to all people, which is really a radical acceptance to all the different people that God has created.
Yes.
That it unlocks this depth of community that you don't find within the assimilated demands of sameness you find in most churches.
Yeah.
You just don't get it.
One of the absolutely beautiful things that you get when you allow queer people to be themselves is, I don't know why I'm trans.
Hmm.
I know there's some scientific explanations around brain development versus body development. Yeah. Like there's
big deal.
Yeah. Hypotheses that are still being tested, but I can't actually say why I'm trans. I know I am.
Yeah.
But that has helped me, and I am an engineer by training and my life, and I like things to make sense. But that's even helped me be comfortable with some level of mystery, right? And some level of, we don't actually have to figure out all of this, right? Yeah. We can let things be surprising and mysterious, and, you know, and we can enjoy that, right? We can enjoy that we don't know all the time. I talk about, you know, other things of like, you want to, I always think, if you want somebody to talk about the transfiguration or the resurrection or God becoming man, right?
Yeah.
You know who has a lot of thoughts on those things?
Tell me.
Trans Christians. Okay. Right? Like, because if there's anybody who has thoughts on these huge transformations of something looking like one thing and actually being another, right? It's like, you're going to have so much there that you're going to miss if you shut out those voices.
Oh, that's so good.
And so and in the same way that, like, again, if you don't have immigrants in your church, you're going to miss a lot of what Jesus is, his position in the world, right? You're going to miss all that. You know, if, you know, it's just
So many There's churches so are much sterilized.
That you miss when you, yeah, when you demand that everybody conform, and even yeah. if somebody comes in who is different, Melting you're like, pot. Okay, you can yeah. be here as long as you turn yeah. into,
yeah, yeah,
right.
Wrote a book
erase
on that.
The parts, erase the parts that are hard, please.
Yeah. So, boo.
Yeah.
The reality is, if you're outside of a metro area, it would be really hard to find in-person communities that have experience with holding intersections really well. You can look, as Jared Stacy suggested, towards communities on the margins, especially folks who are thinking about or have already left Christian church community because of the harm. We can look at the possibilities that God exists in these different expressions, different perhaps ethnicities, but certainly across intersections, be it queer church, recovery church, could be a racialized church. I invite my friend Christian A. Smith to come back. He's from episode 8 to chat a little bit about his community, because we're noticing a trend that there are churches going online, and not just we show the in-person service online, but churches that are embodying a different ethic, not the consumer church variety, but one that seeks to go deeper, surrounding the teachings of Jesus foremost. So we go back to the teaching of love, a radical ethic of love, and what that looks like in public and in community. Here's Christian.
We root everything in the greatest commandment. When Jesus was asked, what's the greatest commandment in all the law? He responded that you love God with your heart, soul, mind, and your strength. And the second part is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. And traditionally in church spaces, we separate love for God and love for neighbor itself. And they'll say, you know, you got to love God first, because he mentioned that first. Yeah, he mentioned it first, but it's very interesting. The term there, the second part is like it. That term like in the Greek means of equal rank.
Mm.
So love for God is of equal rank with love for neighbor itself. And then Jesus reinforces that in the next verse, because he says all of the law and all of the prophets hinge on these two. So you can't get love for God without love for neighbor itself. That's what he's teaching in this moment. Your love for God yeah. is expressed in how you love your neighbor. And then your love for your neighbor is rooted in how you love yourself. And the self-love yeah, yeah. part is the part that we always leave out.
Whew, and forget.
And in some spaces, we don't just leave it out. We teach against it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Deny yourself. Deny Absolutely. That body.
Ooh. Absolutely. The flesh you gotta die to yourself daily. The flesh has to be put under subjection.
Can't right? trust that.
So we are indoctrinated and conditioned to hate ourselves.
Yeah, yes.
We
yes.
are indoctrinated towards self-loathing, which is antichrist.
Ooh, a word.
Right? He says, love God, love your neighbor as yourself. Here's what's really interesting about that.
Hmm.
And I didn't write, this is something that I've developed since I wrote my book. I didn't say this in my book, but on the second edition, I'm gonna write this. Jesus never commands anybody to love themselves. He assumes it. He uses self-love as the basis for how you love your neighbor, which is the basis for how you love God. So yeah, yeah. love God and love your neighbor is the greatest commandment. Love yourself is the greatest assumption. And what I recognize is we don't have the luxury in our context of assuming that people know how to love themselves.
Yeah. 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 Okay. Okay.
So in my context, beloved community looks like people learning to love themselves. Because the more you learn to love yourself, you project that onto the people around you. It's very difficult to give to somebody else what you don't have.
Mm-hmm.
So how can I love you if I don't love myself? How can I love God if I don't love you? And then that's the reason why we have a lot of people in our community who are either agnostic or atheist. Because
it's a good ethic.
You see what I'm saying? What yeah. grounds it is
yeah.
your love for God is expressing how you love your neighbor, which is a reflection of how you love yourself. So if I have somebody who's like, well, I don't really believe in the whole God thing, that's cool. Commit to loving your neighbor as yourself. Everything else will take care of itself.
Yeah, and you got it though.
Yeah, you see what I'm saying? Oh man. So that is the undercurrent mm-hmm. of beloved community in my context. Right. Yeah. We're always reinforcing that at every turn. So instead of us in our context asking, well, what does the Bible say about that? We've replaced that question with how does the greatest commandment apply here?
Yeah. Easy. Easy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's much easier to comprehend.
Yeah.
It's sure. much more difficult to apply.
Yep. Yeah. So how do you get there? For a community that is online or digital in different ways and forms of how people can interact, what does the embodied characteristic of love look like? Because if we just leave it as the first pillar, then it becomes a head exercise, which is what we have been pressing against the whole time. How do we bring it to become an emotive and embodied characteristic in the context of community?
Yeah, we talk a lot about how our spirituality and our emotions are connected. Mm. Like you can't be spiritually mature and be an emotional infant. That's a...
Oh, hold up. T-shirt. Come on now.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
That's a Peter Scazzaro quote. He's the author of Emotionally Healthy Spirituality.
Yeah.
And I'm in a different vein than Peter Scazzaro, obviously, but I found a lot of good nuggets in his work. And he was the first person I saw to really make that connection between spirituality and emotional health. And my wife is a therapist. She is a religious trauma expert.
So she's busy.
Yeah. And she's just busy in the faith community. Like the faith community keeps her busy because she's, you know, constantly helping us to work through the connection between our emotional health and our spiritual health. Mm-hmm. So that is something that we take very seriously. So just give you an example of, like, you know, how we minister to people in the digital space. One of the things that I tell my ministers, because I have a team of digital ministers who are in the community that are ministering to people throughout the day. And one of the things I tell them, and this is like emotional intelligence that helps you be a better minister. When you are engaging with somebody in the digital space and you want to, like, respond to them and maybe push back a little bit, maybe give them another perspective on this that they haven't considered. I tell them all the time, step one, affirm. Step two, expand. But you got to start with the affirmation, because the affirmation lets the person know that you're on their side, that you are seeking common ground and commonality with this person. And then it opens them up to how you expand their thinking. But if you just go in with a correction without any type of affirmation, you will have lost that person more than likely, right? So that helps us to build deeper connections, because we realize, okay, we're on each other's side. We're here to help each other. We're here to learn from each other. And it just makes for a rich experience where people talk all the time just about, like, how much. One of the things I always say is, I love it here. And they're talking about a digital space, because we create culture digitally.
Yeah.
And people can feel it when they enter the space and when they interact.
And that's not given enough. And I've been in this boat as well to like 10, 15 years ago, be like, nah, online church, nah.
Yeah.
And now done a 180. But the magnitude that you can shape and form culture so that others can feel the difference in the digital community.
Yeah.
And in that digital community, am I hearing that the practices are such that the pursuit is connection, but depth of connection, which is like an exercise in reconciling behavior of trying to not merely go deeper, but love with one another.
Yeah, absolutely.
So simple.
Why
isn't everyone doing that?
Because it's too easy. We were told that faith was supposed to be complicated, right? So we have a faith in like fundamentalist spaces that is nonsensical.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we put it that way. Yeah.
But the application of it is very like cut and dry. Don't do this. Yeah, don't do regimented. This. Don't do this. Yep. Don't do this. Mm-hmm. You can do this, but don't do this. Don't do this. Don't do this. We don't have a list of rules. We ask people to consider, how am I loving my neighbor and how I love myself? Am I causing harm to myself with this action or this thought process? Yeah, am I causing harm to any of my neighbors with this action or this thought process? You know what? Just in case I'm not sure if I'm harming any of my neighbors, let me ask some of my neighbors, what do y'all think about this? If I have a thought that might be harmful to the LGBTQ plus community, well, let me ask some of my Q plus siblings in this congregation, in this community, what do y'all think about this? So we're learning to love each other better because we're coming at it from the perspective of, we're trying to live together in beloved community. So how can I show up for you? How can I show up for myself? And how can you show up for me? And how can you show it for yourself?
That's so good. Yep.
I appreciate it. We've been working at it. We've been working at it.
Yeah. There's always, and this is an affirmation to you, in that, you know, you make these choices of, okay, I'm going to give it all away for free, or, oh, hey, you know, let the community shape and form. But it's actually okay, and it's good in many ways to make, we would call it a barrier, but to articulate just the basic, we'll call it, I don't know if you would call it like this, but you don't have rules, you have an ethic.
Right.
An ethic of how to live. And it's okay to land on these things and be like, yo, this is what we are about in this place. And you can leave if you don't like it, but we're trying to figure out what deeper looks like in a better way.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, we don't agree on everything. Where when you get multiple people in the space, there are going to be disagreements. We're not trying to force agreement. We just want, the thing that we agree on is that we're going to honor each other's lived experiences. So if my lived experience is different from yours, both of those can be true at the same time. And I honor the fact that your lived experience is different than mine. And I'm going to honor the fact that my lived experience is real. And as long as we're not harming each other, then we agree to disagree. Or we agree that we just have different paths. But harm is where we draw the line.
Yeah.
Harm is where we draw the line. And it has served us well up to this point. And I expect it to continue to serve us well.
As we come together to the close of this episode 12, the summary episode, where I asked many of my guests the question of what does liberation look like, I hope that you are able to pull in some of the possibilities that are out there for reimagining what it looks like to venture and meander with friends around this faith that we call Christianity. Maybe you want to discard that part. What does it look like to be Christ followers? That also might give you hives. So let's just say we're returning to the potential of the teachings of Jesus that include the radical love component of these subversive acts to upend empire and ultimately the chase for freedom, wholeness, and liberation for all. Now, the road back towards wholeness is one that is long and requires endearment. It takes some time, especially if you have spent many years, perhaps decades, disembodied and dysregulated in religious spaces, to find the tools, the pathways, the resources to come back to yourself. We end with Dr. Ed Eng. He's going to come to share a little bit, and he was in episode 3, if you remember, about the journey of healing,
how the journey of healing is not something that is linear, that has an endpoint. Rather, it's one where we meander around together, and hopefully you can embark on your journey of healing with some faithful and forgiving friends.
So the very first thing is something you and I had talked about previously, which is to say that if people have found themselves in outright abusive contexts, they're going to have to leave them. And it's absolutely within their best interest to leave them. And to a certain extent, what constitutes abuse can be subjective, right? But of course, there are things that are physical or sexual or verbal or emotional that we can kind of delineate as being like, that was really definitely harmful for you. Mm-hmm.
Trust that. I think that's good to just like leave folks with at least trust your gut, your body, in a right. faith that actually designed and said, don't trust your body because it's sinful. And that's like a reclamation to flip it around. Be like, yeah. Trust your gut. Yeah, that wasn't right.
Right. Yes. Something has gone wrong. And the way that I've been taught or the way that I've been treated, the way that I see myself, now something is definitely like warped within me. And so leaving those contexts, finding safety, that's a big part of it. But in terms of deconstruction, I would say the first thing that comes to mind is how lonely that process is.
Mm-hmm.
How few guides and mentors there are who could help us through those processes of simply talking through the experiences we've had. Mm-hmm. Of helping us put in context why people do the things they do. Why is it that Asian churches have this particular flavor to it? You know, I grew up going to Chinese churches, like, you know, and those of us who have grown up going to Chinese churches, right? There's this thing, like there's this way of being. You know, sometimes I miss it. Sometimes I miss the dumpling making around Chinese New Year. Sometimes I miss like community lunches where, you know, like all the aunties in the kitchen would get together and make it and all that stuff. Right? I miss that stuff. I don't have that anymore. What Chinese churches were places where people feel like they could be themselves in a culture that didn't necessarily accept them. You know, if you trace some of the development of the Chinese church in Canada in particular, you know, when my dad came in the early 60s for university, he told me, he said, we didn't feel welcome in the white churches, so we made our own.
Yeah, exactly. That's why they emerged. You could not find belonging in the white churches.
Right. And so, but part of the issue then is that they, out of the sense of needing to huddle together, the fear that's bound them together, now then there's some issues with that, obviously, which leads to people sort of pulling together using maybe elements of moralism or abused what that's led to is a lot of people coming from out of these churches feeling disoriented and wanting to like, well, isn't there more than this? Isn't there more to being a Christian than just following the rules? And they've seen in their own lives and the lives of others that that's simply not enough. So going back around, this idea of loneliness, because you mentioned grieving, and I'm like, yes, for the most part, grief is like really lonely. So when I work with people who are grieving something significant or someone significant, there's no actual way to sort of fix it, right? It's this thing that keeps coming back. You'll miss that person forever. The rest of your life, you're going to miss that person. Ugh. You know, do I have to live with this forever? Yeah, you do. And that's going to suck, right? One thing I always tell myself is, I mean, well, good thing it sucks because it means you love them because they were precious to you. And that's why it sucks. That's why you grieve. Something to think about is instead of making grief a purely solitary process, maybe one thing to consider is lamentation, which is a community act. And it's been said so many times before that churches are just awful at it because, again, they're responding to the impulse to be therapeutic.
Yeah.
Right. This has got to be happy. And like, we got to be like being sad. No, we can only tolerate that for 5 minutes at a time.
Yeah, 5 minutes a year. Yeah.
5 minutes a year, right? If even, right? Or a lamentation service is something that is you know, like once in a church's history kind of thing. And, oh, that was nice. Well, we'll never do it again.
Remember back in 83. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly, right? Finding space to grieve with someone well can be a gift along the deconstruction process. Boy, that was good. I miss the aunties making dumplings in the kitchen. But you know what? Like that came with so much other stuff that I'm not sure. I miss all of that, right? And some of this can be done with a good counselor, a good therapist.
Who do we send the bill to, Ed? All these folks coming out of their religious upbringing who've got mounds of therapy ahead of them. Who gets to foot that bill? Seriously.
Oh, man. Unfortunately, it's the people who have the courage to leave it, right?
yeah, I know.
The way mental health system works in Canada.
Dang. And America's worse. Well, it's the same.
Yeah.
We end with courage. With those who have taken the step outside of malformed faith traditions, abusive traditions, there are a lot of folks out there processing deconstruction who are leaving, who are escaping malformed Christian traditions, in particular conservative and evangelical traditions, which are high control, that rely on propaganda and conspiracy theory. And unfortunately, in this day and age, are church traditions that have a lot of social power. If enough folks leave these churches, I think we have a chance to turn the tide towards better. What does better look like? We captured some glimpses of what the way of Jesus specifically looks like, which is language that you would still hear within churches. But what we've noticed is that very few churches know how to embody radical ethics of love, liberation, and justice in their neighborhoods, cities, and beyond. It's been my hope that through these episodes, you have found glimpses and glimmers and possibilities and dreams of what better can look like. It's out there. Some of it is online. Some of it might be close to home. And throughout the journey, as you chase for wholeness, for better, for ultimate liberation, may you find that with a few faithful, forgiving friends along the way. My name is Ro Hatty. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget to rate and review. Daniel Wheat, Jesse Peters, intros and outros and bumper music. Thank you to all the guests who came through. This has been a Ro Berry publication recording on Treaty 7 territory in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. Next up, a bonus episode on Palestine and Gaza. You can find me online, rohatty.com. And all the different socials. You can also find in the show notes some of the communities that were mentioned, including Christian A. Smith and my own community called A Beautiful Table.
Open the window to a sky full of clouds. It's been nothing but rain now for what feels like a month. Open the window to a sky full of clouds. There's been nothing but rain now for what feels like a month. I know spring is coming, but I need you right now. I know soon the sun will break through and I'll feel your light. Open the window to a sky full of clouds. There's been nothing but rain now for what feels like a month. Open the window to a sky full of clouds. There's been nothing but rain now for what feels like a month. I know spring is coming, but I need you right now. I know know soon the sun will break through and I'll feel your light. I know spring is coming, but I need you right now. I know soon the sun will break through and I'll feel your light. I feel your light. I need.